Welcome to a worldwide online meeting with John Sherman. This meeting was broadcast live from Ojai, California on November 1st, 2008.
Okay, here I am, and here you are, and I am inordinately happy to be here with you in this virtuality where we meet here. I'm going to start by reading a very short email that I received on Wednesday. It was initially intended for me to receive it prior to the Wednesday open house, but I didn't see it until later. And, just let me read it to you. Hi, John. I thought I'd try to be concise and email you prior to your internet open house. I am not suicidal, nor do I seek sympathy. I am more fortunate than most people in this world, but I am trying to be honest. However, if you feel sharing this would cause hurt, feel free to ignore it. Well, I have no idea what causes hurt and what doesn't cause hurt, but no one can be harmed by the communication of sincere reports as to the state of things in your mind, in your life, in your world. I actually don't ignore much of anything that comes from you guys. So to continue, these, he goes on, are my observations and my interpretations. Unless I am mistaken in either, I see no point in any endeavor, including seeking. I have no control over thoughts. Awareness of me happens spontaneously and in timelessness. Attempts to seek me happen in time, which is thought, afterwards, and are futile. Awareness of me happens spontaneously and in timelessness. Attempts to seek me happen in time, afterwards, and are futile. The whole of life seems to be based on a fear of death, even if one is fortunate enough to have no logical reason to suggest this is imminent. The majority of life takes place in time, and indeed one would not be able to function in the world if the state of timeless no thought persisted. This life is a temporary mixture of highs and lows, pleasures and pains, and seems to serve no purpose. With the demise of the body, there is only timelessness and no person, which will be the case regardless of what one does. Is not life, therefore, just a pointless interval where one waits for death? I'm not. Here's the thing. Your description of life and its essentially absurdist character, its absurd nature, its uselessness and its pointlessness and so forth is rings true as a kind of an accurate representation of what a life of suffering, a life of misery, a life of discontent. It is a summation of what the assertion that life is suffering points to, actually, your letter, your email, your summing up of the pointlessness of life. I am certain that anyone who cared to reflect upon the things that you've said here would have to conclude in the end that this is a universal experience about the nature of life as a human being. It's a universal presentation of what it feels to be human in a life that is pointless and filled with pain and confusion and wanting and not getting and not wanting and being unable to get rid of things, thoughts, experiences, emotions, and so forth. Thoughts, things, emotions, and so forth, sensations, phenomenal arisings, and so forth, that illuminate nothing, that lead to no understanding or no transformation or transcendence of the uselessness of life. Things and thoughts and sensational experiences that have no point to them. They come and they go. Nothing's changed. Nothing moves. Nothing is gained, and nothing is really lost in any of them. The value of this presentation, this concise and well elaborated and simply worded presentation of the misery of life is precisely in its universality. In any human life, these same things could be said of any human life. These same things could be said. No control over thoughts. Awareness of me happens spontaneously. Well, and I'm not sure that I would quite agree with the idea that awareness happens in timelessness. I think awareness requires time in order to be, actually. Awareness is not in timelessness. Reality, perhaps, but not awareness. But that attempts to seek me happen in time and are futile. Futile in that certainly the attempts to look at you, and there is an extremely important, extremely powerful distinction to be made between the verb seek and look. There is an extremely important distinction to be made between the idea that I am seeking myself or I am trying to look at myself. Those are two very different approaches. And the actuality of the vichara seeks nothing. Seeking implies some expectation or hope of getting something. Nothing is to be gotten here. Nothing needs to be sought. No seeking needs to be ended. The possibility of looking at yourself, of course that happens in time. You know, I've said before, and I'll say it one more time, a quote from Nisargadatta, which is that I'm quite fond of, in which he points out that for those who fear time, and certainly there is a fear of time that is based on the fear of death, certainly that is the case. But he points out that for those who fear time, those who fear time are time's prey. Those who fear time are time's prey. For those who do not fear time, time is the prey. Now, what this means to me in my own actual experience, this kind of mysterious pronouncement from Nisargadatta, what this means to me in my own personal experience is that in the absence of the fear of extinction. In the absence of the fear of failing to, of failing in the endless project of identity construction, in the absence of the fear that I will not get what I came for, or that there is nothing here to be gotten to begin with, in the absence of the fear that is predicated on the conviction that I am at stake here and in danger here, and one of the dangers is that I will discover that life is pointless and meaningless and a meaningless interval between birth and death, waiting for death. As long as that fear persists, that fear itself is precisely the fear of time. And that fear of the unfolding of time, the tick-tock of the clock from birth to death, the fear of that, the fear of the inevitability of extinction, coupled with a kind of magical thinking idea that if I can, that isn't even precisely formulated, this idea, this magical thinking idea, this magical thinking that if I can somehow become what I need to be, whether that is like in some religious circles that might be become saved and redeemed, in some spiritual circles that might be become enlightened or become become a being with no thought and timelessness and so forth, and a sense that there is something that I can become, some identity that I can construct or evoke or turn to, something that I can become that will reveal the deathlessness of me. So the fear of death, coupled with the idea, the magical thinking idea, that there's some identity that I can fit into that will make me deathless, that will make me safe and protected from the vicissitudes of life, the changes of life, that is, and and its inevitable ending. And the absence of that, well, life actually is seen to be food and nourishment. It is seen to be, this life, just as it unfolds, is seen very clearly to be itself the purpose of life. The purpose of life is to see, to look. The purpose of life has nothing to do with becoming anything, with forming any particular identity. It has nothing to do with gaining enlightenment. It has nothing to do with gaining redemption or transformation or transcendence or any of that. It has nothing to do with stopping time or eliminating the certainty of the grave at the end of life. You're not going to that grave. You're not. You're here. You're here. So long as we are driven by this underlying complex of hope and fear, of hope and fear, of hope for an escape and fear that there is none, of hope for the possibility of a perfect identity that will save me, and fear that it's not possible based on my continuous experience in the effort of the identity, the project of identity construction. The purpose of life is to look. Just to look. The purpose of life, the purpose of all creation, is flows from the evolutionary nature of the appearance of life, the evolutionary nature of the appearance of creation, the evolutionary nature of the appearance of consciousness, which is creation, which is life. Its evolutionary nature is says that the states that it is currently undergoing are impermanent and that always will be impermanent. But the driving force of that evolution, the evolutionary force itself, seems to be the impossibility of reality not to look at itself. So long as reality is, reality looks at itself. And it is that requirement, that kind of metaphysical requirement within the nature of being that gives rise to the evolutionary unfolding of creation and the arising of consciousness and the arising of self-consciousness within all of that. So the only usefulness to the whole show is the usefulness that comes from serving as the instrument, the eyes and ears and nose and taste buds and sensory apparatus and thought forms and all of that that flow and unfold and manifest as this life. What we talk about life is not life, therefore, just a pointless interval. When we talk about life in those terms, we can only be speaking about this limited bubble of personal self-consciousness still trapped in the idea that, or still affected by, colored by, distorted and corrupted by the sense of danger and hope. The sense of the need to escape, the need to be free, the need to find contentment, the need to rid myself of discontent, the need to be something satisfying and permanent. Life, that life, is this personal consciousness that we are looking at all the time. And mistaking it for the ground of our project of identity construction. We look at thoughts and the way they flow. We look at states and the way they come and go. And we must, driven by this complex of fear and hope, it is impossible for us not to identify good and bad. What might fulfill the hope? What surely will fulfill the fear? Good and bad. What I want, what I don't want. What I want to be most of all, and what I don't want to be most of all. We see life in that term. It is our relationship with life is entirely based on this foolish idea that we are at stake here, that there's something to be gotten here, that there's something in this instance of self-consciousness that must be rescued or transcended or transformed or enlightened or made whole. Ignoring our everyday experience that this that we are calling our life, which is nothing other than the endless unfolding of thought form, to which we have assigned identity, upon which we have bestowed the labels of good, bad, or indifferent, in order that I can keep track of what I need to try to hold on to and what I need to try to get rid of. I need to hold on to or try to hold on to those things that promise me some pleasure or contentment or some hope of satisfaction in the future. We try to get rid of the things that we have already cataloged as being undesirable so that when they arise again or when forms similar to them arise again, we don't need to waste our time worrying about them. We recognize that for what it is. That's boredom. That's undesirable. That's frustration. That's undesirable. That's ignorance. That's undesirable. That's excitement. That's desirable. That's pleasure. That's desirable. That's satisfaction. That's desirable. And the whole project of identity construction is driven by this determination as to whether the parts of what I perceive to be the parts of me flowing within this consciousness and within this sense of self-consciousness, the thought forms, the states, the pleasures and the pains, all of that, that I identify to be, I somehow have come to the conclusion, or parts of me, like a Lego set that I have to choose and cobble together some identity that, although I have no basis for hoping so, that I hope will survive, or will get whatever it is that makes survival unnecessary. Get rid of the things that I've already known to be useless and pointless and so forth. But all of this judgment about what's useless and what's useful, what's good and what's bad, what's satisfactory and what's unsatisfactory, is entirely based on an extremely limited paradigm that says that this sense of self-consciousness is me, that I am on the line here, that I must create something that will stick, that I won't have to constantly be working on. When that goes, and that goes, I promise you, as a consequence, no matter how bumpy the ride may seem, and actually it's my experience that as the vichara begins to take hold, the sense of irritation and frustration and not getting it and pointlessness of it all actually can become more intense, it can become sharper. But when the vichara takes hold, and in the end, in the final analysis, the whole project of identity construction, the whole project of trying to become or be or get rid of what's needed and not needed, that whole project just fades into insignificance, and the reality of the actuality, the reality of the value, the evolutionary value to consciousness in the arising of the sense of self-consciousness in within itself, begins to manifest very clearly. We are here to look. That's all. And we look all the time. And in the forefront of the looking is this engine of construction and destruction, this engine of getting and getting rid of, this engine of evaluation and judgment, this engine of saying, I don't want that, I do want this. And that's what goes. And I tell you, in my personal experience, you know, has nothing to do with timelessness and no thought. Timelessness and no thought are quite sweet and quite pleasant, and I experience them every night when I go to sleep, and sometimes in the daytime when I take a nap. But our purpose here has nothing to do with timelessness and no thought. Timelessness and no thought is that from which consciousness has arisen, lifted, uplifted by this evolutionary movement toward self-knowing, universal self-knowing within consciousness, universal self-consciousness, within consciousness. And I tell you that in the absence of that whole project, and in the absence of that whole adventure of trying to become something, of trying to get something, of trying to get rid of something, this creation, which is consciousness itself, this creation which is endlessly arising like an infinitely broad and deep and wide river, infinitely always moving, always arising, always in a state of change and display and movement, and this consciousness that I look at, that I not even to say that I see it is even saying too much, that I endlessly look at, that I endlessly serve as the instrument of this consciousness, which consists in the endless arising and changing of thought form and sensation and relationship and opinion and understanding and lack of understanding and frustration and satisfaction, and all of those things, all of those unnameable, energetic, phenomenal arisings that we have assigned name to, all of them are here in their true light, and I am agape in wonder at what I see, just like you. I don't see anything different from you, but I am agape in wonder and delight and dumbstruck at the gift of this interval of self-consciousness, this interval of the appearance of self-consciousness within this ocean of consciousness. It's of no consequence to me whether I recognize that which comes as frustration or satisfaction, and it's of no consequence to me when I call it frustration, nor is it of any consequence when I call it satisfaction. The truth is, it is the same. That too, part of the infinitely changeable display that is consciousness, that is creation. And where is the one who waits for death? Here, I find no such being here. The dead do not complain about death. It's only the living who complain about death. And the living, free from the fear and hope that drive us into this truly futile project of identity construction, which we drag into our spiritual understanding, we drag into our religious understanding, we drag into our philosophical and metaphysical and political understanding. This complex of fear and hope. The absolute certain end of this fear, hope, foolishness. This thing that appeared unbidden, spontaneously, a kind of evolutionary throwback, an evolutionary dead end. This feeling that I am here and I am in danger, that I am here and I am not being satisfied, that I am here and I am not getting what I want. I am here and I don't even know what I want. I am here and I don't even know where to look for what I want. I am here and I cannot get rid of what I don't want. This evolutionary throwback that appears in the first arising in what is the true sudden awakening of the sense of self-consciousness within consciousness that happened in the very beginning of your life, my life, the being finished with that is being finished with all waiting for death, all interest in the abandonment of life. Now the thing is that none of our ideas about, you know, we have stumbled upon this spiritual, the possibility of a spiritual solution in the course of our lives of misery and hopelessness and frustration and wanting and not getting and so forth. We have stumbled upon this idea of a spiritual solution, and we have fallen into this really magnificent space of spiritual utterance and spiritual discourse and spiritual belief and spiritual ideas, spiritual understanding. And we think that these ideas that we have received from all of the spiritual teachings, we think that they are describing or offering to us something apart from what we are, something new, something not tried before, something different from what's here now. And we, therefore, even as we enter the vichara, we have no choice because of our conditioning, because of our self-conditioning. We have no choice but to look at our life in the same way as the spiritual teachings and the spiritual understandings and the spiritual discourse have told us things should be, so that we take these really gorgeous and magnificent and wonderful utterances and we turn them into tools and raw material in our project of identity construction. And we think that what we need is the state of timelessness and no thought, of no mind, of no desire, of no confusion, of no pain, no misunderstanding. But the truth is that all of this, and I include in this all of the religious teachings, all of the spiritual teachings, all of the philosophical and metaphysical adventures and investigations into the nature of reality, into the nature of things, into the nature of human life and its frustration and its hopelessness and so forth. All of these things, and of course not only hopelessness, but hope, the great hope of salvation, of redemption, of transcendence, of transformation. We turn all of these things into tools and raw material in our project to construct an identity. And we miss the point of them. We use them as ways of keeping ourselves, because this idea that we have to be something in particular that has a definition and has a shape to it and has characteristics and so forth. This idea is the most primal idea of all in the evolutionary arising of self-consciousness. It cannot be seen. It cannot be argued out of. There's no understanding that can dawn upon you and rid you of this worm of an inferential belief about your relationship to life. But all of these stories and exhortations and hymns and scriptures and the whole array of things that are given to us as which we receive as what we think are clues and directions and instructions as to how to get what it is, get rid of this neediness, this fearfulness, this anxiety, that give us instructions and descriptions and help and so forth, and ridding us of that and bringing a new dawn of clarity and beauty and so forth. What they really are just commentary on you. Every bit of it is commentary on you. Every sutra, every Upanishad, every shastra, every sermon, every epistle, every sermon preached from every pulpit in every religion is commentary on you. Really. That's all. It's commentary on you. And that being the case, therefore, it's not surprising that the only thing we can do, and I mean this from my heart, there's nothing else that works, nothing. There are things that can be, you know, temporarily provide some amelioration and some comfort and some passing clarity and so forth, but none of them work in putting an end to the idea that life sucks, that life is suffering. None of them. And they're all about you. Therefore, prior to everything else, if we have been drawn into this spiritual game by these teachings, by these ideas, by these concepts and beautiful, fragrant, wondrous insights, if that's what's drawn us into the spiritual arena, then see that this is all talk about you, and start first, look at you. Just look at you. Not your true self, not beingness, not timelessness or no thought or no mind, not emptiness, not clarity, not freshness, not freedom, not liberation, not God, not any of that. Just look at you. Just the ordinary, everyday you that is at the bottom of the whole show. Because you are at the bottom of it, really. And you're here. You're never absent. You are the most ordinary thing in all creation. You're never absent, you never change, you're untouched, you're unmoved, you're unhelped, you're unhurt, you're as you have always been, and you are absolutely forever accessible to yourself. Now, because we have been so deeply engaged in the project of identity construction for so many years, so many generations, really, so many thousands and thousands of years, because we have had our attention devoted unknowingly to this project of identity construction for all of that time, we don't know what you feels like. I mean, we know it because I'm never absent from it. It's never not here. But I don't know that I know what I feel like. I think that where I must look to see my state or to see myself is either in the construction site, which is this bubble of personal consciousness, or in some idea I have gotten from reading or hearing or experiencing in meditation practice and so forth. Spiritual ideas, like no thought, emptiness, awareness. And all the time we are looking always in the same realm, which is the realm of this project, the realm of the accumulation of ideas and pieces of lumber and doors and windows and flooring and all of that that constitute the body of thought and memory and understanding and insight that I have garnered or have heard tell of in my passing. So, of course, that's where we look. We look in the construction site and see what's changed. What's changed here? Has thought departed? Because I know all the masters tell us that no thought is the goal of all striving. Has thought departed? Well, no, it hasn't. Has boredom departed? Well, no, it hasn't. That's the same thing I always called boredom in the past. That must still be here. Have I become immortal? No, I haven't. My body is still aging. Have the experiences of frustration and confusion and so forth, have they departed? No, they haven't. But the thing that is departing in the course of your conscious entry into the vichara, the thing that is departing and that you have never suspected to be here and therefore will not notice its absence until probably long after it's gone, is this whole premise that I am here to become something. I am here to do right. I am here to find the right way. I am here to escape from here. That's what it comes down to. That whole premise is disappearing. From the moment that you first turn your attention with an earnest and open-eyed and fresh curiosity just to see what it is I'm talking about when I talk about you, from the moment that you enter into that project, the project of getting a glimpse of yourself, the reality of you, this that is never absent, this certainty of being that is you, from the moment that you first embark upon this seriously and sincerely, that premise is evaporating. And when that premise is gone, life is, well, it is what it has always been. It is sweet. It is dramatic. It is delicious. It is frightening, it is satisfying, it is frustrating, it is this entire wonder of movement and shape and form and energy and coming and going. You are just the looker. You are the looker upon all of this, as you have always been. And your stake in this, as if this had a stake in the idea that there is a project underway here to perfect personal consciousness, that goes. And then you see the purpose of life. Then you see, actually, as you have always seen without knowing it, the purpose of the evolutionary arising of consciousness within reality. Then you see, as you have always seen, the purpose and the meaning of creation itself, and the purpose and the meaning of the arising, the evolutionary arising of self-consciousness. So, here's what I say. There is only one thing that works. And you know, it's of absolutely no significance to me how or in what way this thing can be spoken of in spiritually correct terminology. I am actually quite skilled at spiritual terminology, but I have lost much interest in it. It is of no consequence how to make the connection between spiritual terminology, religious terminology, philosophical terminology, and so forth, and the reality that you already see. There's no point to it. And in my experience, what happens is that one loses interest in that whole realm. So that I really don't care how the spiritually advanced mind looks at and thinks about the practice of entering the vichara consciously in your own life. It really is of no consequence to me how that is looked upon from the standpoint of advanced spiritual understanding. Here's what I know. Nothing else works. The rest of it is all commentary. Nothing else works. Consider this. Reflect upon this. We have been in this game of spiritual aspiration for 5,000 years now. And likewise in the game of religious aspiration for a very similar length of time, ever since we gave up the idea of animism long ago. We have been in the game of religious and spiritual aspiration for at least 5,000 years. At least. We've been in the game of chasing after the bait and the sweets that are offered to us in religious and spiritual utterance for 5,000 years. To what effect? Really? How many? Really? Have found an end to, a true end to the hope and fear that drives us all. How many? As a result of all of our spiritual work, all of our spiritual aspiration, all of our spiritual understanding. How many? Really? Compared to the number of people who have lived and died. The number of instances of the arising of personal consciousness and the falling away of personal consciousness. How many? How many of us have there been? Billions. 6 billion of us now. Maybe, who knows, I don't know. I mean, surely there are more of us now than have ever been alive at the same time before. Most of the human beings who have ever been alive are alive now, the great majority. But let's say use 6 billion as the term. We're even more of us than that. But even with 6 billion, how many out of 6 billion have found an end to this absurdity of seeing life as misery and suffering? How many? 5? 10? 100 maybe? 1,000? About 1,000 maybe? Out of 6 billion? How about 10 million out of 6 billion? You think 10 million of us have found the way home as a result of all of our spiritual and religious work over this 5,000 years? Think maybe 10 million compared to 6 billion. Truth is, therefore, that no matter how beautiful, no matter how true, no matter how inspiring, no matter how sweet and gorgeously attractive our spiritual and religious discourse and aspiration has been, it has not done us much good. Because you see, and you can see this also in the fact that within even the most exalted spiritual practices and spiritual teachings, they are all being directed toward an individual self-consciousness. they're all being directed toward that construction zone, a particular construction zone, promising freedom for that. Even those who see and clearly enunciate the central role of compassion in liberation, even that is being taught to and preached to a personal consciousness. It is providing aid and comfort to the construction project, tools and materials, theories to the construction project. So how many? Not many. What good has it done us? Not much. I mean, it's beautiful, and it's not to be discarded, you know, quite to the contrary. But it doesn't work. We are in this together. It is not possible for one person to be free. That is absurd. There is one human consciousness. How many? Hasn't done us much good. It's been inspiring. It's provided us with pleasure and beauty and all of that, and that can continue. But the thing about the conscious entering of the vichara is that, unlike all the rest of it, and the vichara does not require any spiritual understanding to embark upon it. It doesn't require even coming from a spiritual background to embark upon it. I mean, it's very simple. The instruction is as simple as can be. Look at you. Try. See if you can figure out what I'm talking about. See if there is not within you an alive and fresh and enthusiastic curiosity about these matters, to see for yourself. Not to take John Sherman's word for it, or Nisargadatta's word for it, or Ramana's word for it, or the Buddha's word for it, but to see for yourself. How many of us have seen for ourselves? The movement toward taking upon yourself the determination to see for yourself you, about which all the fuss is. This works. In fact, so far as I can see, it must be absolutely infallible. It doesn't provide immediate, you know, like a quick rush. Doesn't provide anything like that. It doesn't provide an instant salvation. It doesn't provide an end to confusion. It doesn't provide the dawning of total clarity or emptiness or any of that. What it does do is snuff out the problem, which is not the life, not its character, its shape, its brilliance or its stupidity or its beauty or its ugliness. It's not the life. The problem is this little knot of hope and fear that comes about as a result of the seemingly obvious fact that I'm in danger here. I've got to either escape or I've got to fix myself. A little engine of hope and fear. And the vichara destroys that, snuffs that out. The vichara adds nothing. Nothing. It changes nothing. Everything in the life, everything in consciousness is changing all the time. The vichara adds nothing to that. It changes nothing in that. It destroys, snuffs out once and for all the engine of hope and fear that drives the project of identity construction. And then you see. You already see. Then you know what it is you're seeing. Then you'll see for yourself. I promise you, if you... And the other wondrous thing about the vichara, other than its pragmatic usefulness, is that if you just once, just for the second, catch a glimpse consciously and knowingly of what it is that I am trying to get you to look at, it will proceed on its own until the problem is gone. Well, actually, it will proceed on its own forever, as it already has been doing. Because there's nothing to you but the vichara. There's nothing to you but this endlessly arising evolutionary development, unfolding of consciousness within reality. Of consciousness within you. Within you. You are not your life. Your life is you. You are not consciousness. Consciousness is you. But you must look at yourself. You must try. You must make whatever effort you can muster to serve some hopeful sense of curiosity that arises within you. You must see for yourself. No one can give it to you. No one can take it away from you. There's nothing new here. There's nothing special here. There's nothing I have to speak of that you are going to get added on to you. Just look at yourself and see and let me know. Okay. I hope that's helpful. I am always amazed that the things that I say, that people report to me, that the things that I say to them are helpful. I am really grateful to be so. And I hope that what I've said this morning or this afternoon or this evening, wherever you are, is helpful to you. And if you want to talk to me, I think Carla already told you. I'm not even sure myself how you go about doing it. But I think Carla already told you. And if you want to talk to me, I'm happy to talk to you. I'm done for now.
Vanky calling from North Carolina.
Hi, Vanky. How are you? What a beautiful letter you sent me.
Oh, thank you, John. I just wanted to, like, give a very brief report to you and hear what you had to say.
Okay, go ahead.
So, it's all very strange and very nice, and I'm not really sure what to say, but I'm sure any description of it is utterly useless, like I mentioned in my letter. And what I really can say is that, like you always just say, you know, look through the foggy glasses, everything seems kind of hopeless, and it's the letting of the light in that that does all the work. And I had no idea what you meant at the time. And yeah, I have a feeling that we believe ourselves to be, this is my post explanation, the truth of it doesn't seem to matter anymore. I have a feeling that that the image we have of ourselves, what we believe ourselves to be, is superimposed on this life force. And when that superimposition is taken away, things are just shown to be what they are, and it is also revealed to be how it was all your life. And this is how it has been, that you are at the center of it all, and It's simple and ordinary, and it's the correct explanation for life itself. And in your end of your rope video, you had mentioned this, or I'm not really sure, in one of your talks with somebody, you had mentioned that that the belief is an interpretation of the life force as it wants something, and when seen without the belief, you see that it is just the life force, you know, constantly shifting attention, and you see that despite all the coming and going, you never change, and you see that why you never change is you see who you were all your life, and it's very simple, it's very ordinary, and I feel like a fool after for having searched all this glorious spiritual stuff. Actually, I feel like a complete idiot, because you also had said once that there is only like a speck of dust standing between you and your true nature, and I was like, oh, what is John talking about? And now I completely kind of see what you are, and it's difficult to be bothered about life when you see that. I don't know if I've been rambling, but I'll let you respond, John.
I agree. I don't know what response I can give except that what you say is true. And you know, it is the case that the way that we enact this project of identity construction is by projecting identity on the things that come and go as and within consciousness. We project, oh, that's good, that's frustration, that's bad, that's cold, that's not good, that's warm, that's good. But all of these things are our, like, we are the ones who project those identities on the ever-changing, ever-moving river of consciousness. That's the way the identity project proceeds. And then, of course, we have to remember it and hold on to it and keep it all in a coherent and comprehensive package. And the thing to see about that is that really there's no way to stop that from continuing apart from destroying that which drives that on. The sense of entrapment and danger and hope and me and me and me and all of that. So, and the simple thing is that until we begin just to look for ourselves at ourselves, to look for ourselves, taking no one's word for anything, till we begin that, then that's the way life is. Once that effort to look directly at oneself is underway, then even understanding how that all worked in the past becomes really boring. You know, how that project worked in the past becomes really boring, unless you find yourself in a life like this one, in which it's helpful sometimes to people, for me, to try to remember what it's like for that project to be going on. But really, there's no need. Once this engine is gone, there's no need even to understand how it all took place, or why, or from whence it came, or to where it goes. It is here. You are here. You follow that?
Yes, John. That was perfect. You said it very well. We project identity on things that come and go, and once that stops, any description of the process is meaningless. You have said this before, and I never understood why you said the kind of that emotional attachment to finding meaning goes away. And in my case, it was like by you asking me to look at yourself and all that, it felt like somebody had pulled the carpet out from under my feet, you know. It was just very simple, and it was very elegant. And what really happened was, and this you have said too, and as usual, you're right, is that you said you probably have to be like desperate. And then I found myself on this merry-go-round of same explanations and so on and so forth. And I said, okay, let's forget all this and trust in this fact that I need to find myself. And then the most important words from your teaching have been this pointing out that somehow you have never changed. And that's really the one thing that I'm sure is the bulk of the work, is that this, because I could not believe that I haven't changed, and staying with that feeling just basically made it all very simple. And you have always said, the life is what you have wanted, and I never understood it. I was like, how could we want all this hate and misery and suffering and anger and everything? And now, seen in a different light, I know exactly what you mean. But the language is not good enough to describe life is what you have wanted. And actually, I'm a little mind blown this week, so I won't make a lot of sense. So, well, things are, all the complications have been unknotted, and that's really wonderful. And I guess the only thing that needs to be done is to disregard all the spiritual things and just look at you, and it'll all turn out well in the end, like you promised. And I'm overwhelmed and grateful to you and Carla, John, and thank you. Bye.
Oh, you're very welcome. And yes, I can't tell you how. It's just wonderful to hear from you like this. Thank you. Anybody else want to talk to me?
Carolyn, calling from St. George, Utah.
Hi, Carolyn. Good to see you, or you know, see your name here.
Hi, John. Hi, Carla. I'm really enjoying your talk today because it's including some of the things that I've been thinking a lot about recently. But there's something that I don't quite understand, a point that you're trying to make that I don't quite get. And I was wondering if you could explain it more. It's what you're talking about when you say that over the past 5,000 years we've been looking for this individual awakening or individual enlightenment, and that we are not we're not separate individuals. It has to come on a collective level, I think, is what you're saying. And you're saying that the vichara is the way to accomplish this, and I'm not quite sure how the vichara is going to accomplish the collective awakening rather than the individual awakening. And correct me if I've misunderstood what you said.
Well, I don't think you misunderstood what I said. I don't think I am quite as clear in saying what it is I'm trying to say in this as I would like to be, but it's the result of these conversations that I learned how to say it better. So thank you for bringing this up. It's my experience. It is my continuous experience that there is actually no individual for whom liberation can be had. There is the evolutionary arising of a sense of separation and separate consciousness, personal consciousness, self-consciousness, if you will. There is this evolutionary movement that has taken place that we know for certain has taken place within these creatures, these human creatures, and perhaps in other creatures as well, but we don't know that. This this evolutionary arising of self-consciousness brings with it, as a sense of separation, brings with it the sense of an individual persona, an individual being that needs to become what it needs to become in order not to be harmed here, and become what it needs to become in order that it can get what is offered here. That premise is absolutely false. There is certainly the sense of self-consciousness, but that's an evolutionary arising within consciousness itself. It is not separate from consciousness itself. And consciousness itself is endlessly changing and moving and unfolding and morphing and displaying and all of that stuff. Now, I can tell you that that premise is absent here in this aspect of this sense of self-consciousness. There is certainly the sense of separation is present in that, well, I am speaking to you, wherever you might be. There is a sense of you as you and me as me, but there is no sense of personal liberation. The person itself is a construction that is undertaken in obedience to this accidental sense of the need to protect myself and to be something and to gather myself together into a discrete entity and then do what needs to be done within the context of that discrete entity to make it healthy and safe and satisfied and content and clear and enlightened and so forth. As I sit here speaking to you, although there is no sense whatsoever present here, that sense of needing to do something, to become something, to get enlightened, to get saved, to get right, to get on the right side of things, to get understanding, to get insight and all that stuff, there's none of that here. I just report that to you. There's not a shred of that here. But what there is here is what is what the whole of the sense of self-consciousness is shot through with, which is feelings of pain and resistance and frustration and right and wrong and so forth that no longer have any significance in this life, in this aspect of self-consciousness, but they are here because I am not separate from you. If you are confused, confusion is present in the creature that is humanity. If you are hateful, then hatefulness is present in the creature which is humanity. This large aspect of the arising of self-consciousness within consciousness. If fear and hatred and anger and aggression and terror is present in you, that is exactly the same as saying that those projections and those beliefs and those characteristics are present within the creature that is humanity. I am not separate from the creature that is humanity. I am the creature that is humanity, as are you. The whole sense of yourself as being a separate individual requiring separate enlightenment is all predicated on this underlying premise of hope and fear. When the idea of hope and fear goes, so too goes the whole idea that you are a creature separate from the creature that is humanity. which is undergoing this evolutionary development. So the more the vichara is enacted within this creature that is humanity, in the more instances, the more locales in which it occurs within this creature that is humanity, the less ideas and beliefs in fear, hope, frustration, discontent, hatred, anger, and all of that is present in this creature that is humanity. So what I say in this regard is entirely predicated on what I see, which is that humanity is a creature. It's not a collection of creatures, it is a creature, of which this locus is present, in which this locus that's I call John Sherman is present. But the mind of humanity is one. There's no way to protect yourself from that. That's what a lot of the project of identity is striving, identity construction is striving to do, is to find protection and safety from this whole ocean of the confusion and ignorance of the human creature, desperately trying to destroy itself in the name of saving itself, desperately trying to get from itself what it imagined it needs to enhance itself from itself. And if you will allow the possibility that humanity is one creature in consciousness, the whole of humanity is one creature in consciousness, then you see pretty clearly, I think, what it is that I'm pointing to when I say that there is no liberation for any individual. That so long as the idea of fearfulness and anxiety persist in you, they persist in me because I am the same creature as you. I am humanity, as are you. You follow that?
Yes, I do understand what you're saying, and the way I'm understanding it now is that what you're saying is that this is an evolutionary process, and when we reach a critical mass, the oneness of this consciousness will evolve to the level that you're talking about, so that it will be present in all of us, and that until that critical mass is reached, that none of us are free until we all are free.
Yes, that's pretty much what I'm saying. You know, it's certainly the case that within that where you are in the mind that you are most familiar with, it is certainly the case that you can disabuse yourself and rid yourself of the underlying engine that drives the whole misery of the human creature to begin with. And that's certainly the case. But to think that you will be safe and protected from the entire mind of humanity, which is one mind, is and I don't mean you in particular, because I think you follow me, Carolyn, but that is that's the reason, that's one of the reasons why we've been spinning our wheels for so long. But it is an evolutionary force. There's an evolutionary arising. And consciousness is the first part of that evolutionary arising. The appearance of consciousness in reality, which is all of creation. The Big Bang refers to the sudden awakening of consciousness in reality, the sudden appearance of consciousness in reality. That's what all of creation is. And the single mind of humanity is you see, it's not so much an a single mind as it is itself, this evolutionary movement of the appearance of self-consciousness. It's all consciousness. You see, you look at a rock, and if a rock, to me, is sentient. And what I mean by that is that if a rock sits in the sun, it gets warm. And if it gets cold, it gets cold. And certain characteristics of the rock are different when it's warm than when it's cold. That's consciousness. The whole of creation is consciousness. But that rock, so far as I can tell, within that rock, there has not arisen this incredible characteristic of self-consciousness, self-awareness. But within the human creature, that evolutionary leap has taken place. Now, the time it takes for it to establish itself and express itself throughout the entirety of the creature in which it has appeared, well, it's taken some time from the standpoint of a human life, but not much time in the standpoint of the actual unfolding of the evolution of consciousness in reality. Does that help, you see?
Yes, I do. And another thought occurs to me when you talk about the Big Bang, and the Bang is thought of as birth of consciousness, and we might look at it as only the conception, and the birth is when humanity as a whole awakens.
Well, I mean, I don't want to get into trying to get some technical distinctions about these things, but what I am saying, and I'm going to say this, and I'm not going to say much more about it. What I see is that creation is consciousness, and that the appearance of creation at the time of the Big Bang was the evolutionary explosion of consciousness in reality. And that the arising of self-consciousness within the human creature is another evolutionary arising within consciousness itself, the arising of self-consciousness. But you know, and I don't mind talking about that stuff up to a point, but we get to a point where we're trying to make distinctions where distinctions aren't even helpful. Where what we're doing is we're just, and I'm talking about myself, where what we're doing is we're just kind of trying to tweak the definition when the definition is not the thing. You are the thing. And since all that I am saying, just as all that all the others have said throughout all of the history of human aspiration, is nothing more than commentary about you, really. It's just a story that I am telling about you, really. Since that is the case, just as it has always been the case, the only thing that counts here is the invitation to look at yourself. See for yourself. And that looking at yourself, as I'm sure you by now have noticed, evaporates the whatever it is, whatever story I tell about it, whatever story others have told about it, the looking at you evaporates that engine of misery and suffering and separation and wanting and not getting and getting and not wanting. So in the end, all that I say only to tell a story, a context in which to try to persuade you, not you in particular, Carolyn, although you can take it as you in particular if you want, but to persuade you to see that there already is present an alive and fresh curiosity about your nature that is unsatisfied by all of the efforts that have been taken throughout our life to engineer and identify and define our nature. that everything we have done in the past has not satisfied this really present, alive, fresh curiosity about your nature, and that the satisfaction of that comes only from, it doesn't come from any understanding, no matter how eloquent and how beautiful the understanding might be, it doesn't come from any insight, no matter how exciting and pleasurable the arising of the insight might be, it comes from you looking at you. And you're here. You're never absent. And it's the conscious entering of the vichara. See, to me, the whole creation is the vichara. And the conscious entering of the vichara infallibly will take that away. It will add nothing. It will add nothing. But it will take away that which afflicts us. Okay?
Yeah, thank you very much. And I think I understand what you're saying about the distinctions and the definitions and the insights. They come out of who we are, but it's not who we are.
Right, and interestingly enough, too, I mean, if any of us look and honestly consider this, I think all of us can see that understanding has no effect. Understanding doesn't change anything. Insight has no effect. Insight doesn't change anything. Both understanding and insight are phenomenal, sensational arisings that feel good when the puzzle seems to all right. But see, the puzzle only stays connected and comprehensible for a moment, and then it all dissolves again. An insight is another pleasurable, sensational arising that's like a thrill that comes, and then we take it and use it as a tool or as a building material in our endless project to become something. So, yeah, right. Yes, whatever it is, yes. Anything more?
Just one more comment, and then I'll let somebody else talk. What you said about understanding, the Course in Miracles says that your understanding is no great contribution to the truth, and that is so true. So thank you.
You're very welcome. Yes, that's true. Understanding has never, so far as I can see, understanding has never done a understanding has no effect, except, you know, the technical understanding that might have some effect in practical life, although I'm not even sure that's the case. I think practical life pretty much lives itself, and understanding is something we try to add on to it to make it sweeter or something. Okay, anybody else? Okay, then, I always want to be sure to say this to people when I meet with you, and that is that I have become more skillful over time. I have much of the stupidity that used to affect the way that I speak about what I see has fallen away over time. Carla and I have been in this work for about 10 years now, been in this conversation with you for about 10 years now, and it is precisely this conversation with you that deprives me of a lot of the stupid accretions of spiritual understanding that used to probably cause confusion to people who met with me. So I'm becoming more skillful as time goes on, but that's all due to you. You are, in whatever form I meet you, you are my teachers and the ones who show me what is helpful and what is not helpful. The ones who inform me and instruct me as to what is useful and what's not useful. These conversations are, if it's true that this life is serving some evolutionary arising within consciousness, and your life is serving some evolutionary arising within consciousness, that service is entirely predicated, founded on, and fed by these conversations with you. These efforts that I make to say something uncluttered and true to you. So I am endlessly grateful for your work in this, for your help in this, for your attention, for your energetic involvement and working with me. I'm going to go now. Carla, I need you for a minute or so to tell you some things about us and what we're doing and the like. So stick around for a minute or two while Carla talks to you. Next week we won't be here because, and I'm sure Carla intends to tell you this, because we begin our annual five-day retreat here in Ojai. But I will see some of you there, and I will see all of you everywhere, really. And we'll be back. Carla will tell you more about that. Thank you so much for your attention and your time. I love you all. Bye.
You just listened to the live recording of a worldwide online meeting with John Sherman that was broadcast live from Ojai, California on November 1st, 2008. For more live recordings, visit our podcast at www.riverganga.org.